Thank you very much, and well done all those people outside who are hopefully that the screen is working now so you can actually see this Dhamma talk, and it's obviously many people inside as well. It's great to see so many people on such an auspicious night. It's an auspicious night because you're being blessed by auspicious water from the heavens. And the subject of this evening's talk is when bad things happen to good people, because that's sometimes what we want to know the answer to. Why is it I've been a good person, I've done all the right things, and I've been kind and I've been generous, but still bad things happen to me? And instead of people coming to complain to me, because when bad things happen, that's when they do sort of come and ask for some holy water. Because of the title of the talk tonight, when good things happen to bad people, no, when bad things happen to good people, that's the right way around. When bad things happen to good people, it must be the only reason why you come this evening is because you identify with this talk. You must be a good person and a bad thing has happened to you, which is why you come this evening, to find out why. And so very often people ask me to bless them with holy water because good people, bad things have happened to you. So we've arranged a blessing before the talk began, and having finished the blessing with the holy water, actually there's a story of holy water. I don't know if you know this, but if any of you ever travel to Australia and you look at the list of prohibited items to bring into Australia, one of the prohibited items is holy water. It's true. You cannot bring holy water into Australia. Now, I often wondered why that was, and somebody told me the following story which could explain the ban on holy water being brought through the customs into Australia. Because there was a gentleman, an Australian man, who had just come back from Europe. And as he was travelling through the customs in Australia, he went through the Green Channel. And you know that every so often the customs official has to check people going through the Green Channel. And he was selected. "Sir, would you come over here? I just want to check your suitcases." And when the customs officer opened his suitcases, he found underneath all of the jackets and shirts and jumpers was a bottle of undeclared whiskey. And the customs officer said, "Sir, what is this?" And the man said, "I'm a Catholic. I've just been on pilgrimage to the holy city of Lourdes in France. It's holy water. Can I go now?" And the customs officer took the bottle out. He said, "It says Johnny Walker on the outside. What do you mean it's holy water?" And he said, "Well, I had to put it in something. That's all I had. You know, a bottle of Johnny Walker whiskey. It was empty, so I just put the water inside. Can I go?" "No," said the customs officer, "I've got to check this." So he unscrewed the cap and he smelt it. And the customs officer said, "You smell it. This is not water, it's whiskey." And the traveller smelt it and said, "My goodness, you're right. It's another miracle." And because of that, you can't bring holy water into Australia anymore. But anyway, go back to the subject when bad things happen to good people. This occurs every now and again. And sometimes we say, "Why me? Why did that happen? It's not fair." And sometimes we say, "Oh, it must be some karma you did in a past life. You must have been very, very bad in your past life that these things happened to you. You lose your job, you lose your investments, you know, you manage to choose a partner who cheats on you. I didn't do anything, why me?" And you think maybe you must have cheated on your partner in your past life. But you know, a lot of people think that whatever happens to you, especially the bad things which happen to you in this life, you always think there must be some karmic cause of that. But the Buddha specifically said, no, is not always caused by karma from some past life. And even if it was, you cannot remember your past life. So how can we make the connection? Any sort of difficulty or trouble we experience in this life, when we don't find a connection to some act we did previously, its educational deterrent doesn't really work. Why be punished when you don't know why you're being punished? Know why this is happening to me? So it really doesn't make any sense at all to blame something which happens to you in this life on some previous life. Why is it that some people got caught in a tsunami and other people didn't? Why is it that some people die in the earthquakes and others don't? And sometimes you try and find the answer to these questions. It's not always karma. You know, there's a gentleman here who was disabled because he had a tumor, a brain tumor. He said, why did that happen to me? What have I done wrong? Is it some bad karma I've done in the past? They say, no, it's not always a bad karma in the past. I remember this story which really made me understand why these things happen, because when I was a monk in Thailand, there was a young man who came to see my teacher, Ajahn Chah. He had been drafted into the Thai army, and he'd suffered a very terrible wound. It wasn't going to kill him, but it made him disabled. And so he was out of the army, but very difficult to find a job. And so he came up to my teacher, Ajahn Chah, and he said, why did this happen to me? Why was I wounded in such a way that I'm going to have a very difficult life now? Is it some bad karma I did in the past? And Ajahn Chah replied to him, the karmic reason, the cause for why you were shot, was because you joined the army. He said, that's what happens when you become a soldier. You shoot bullets at others, so others will shoot bullets at you. And some of those bullets will hit. If you looked at the contract before you joined the army, you would have seen in the small print that you're liable to be shot by bullets. Most people they would miss, but you got hit. That is the reason why you've got shot. Because you were a soldier. And he extended that to being born a human being. If you had only read the contract before you were born, you would have seen in the bottom, it said that you can get disabled by a brain tumor, by cancer, by a safe falling from on the 14th story while you're underneath it. There's many, many things which can happen to you. That this is part of our life. That these things will happen to some of you. For example, one of the little techniques which I use to tell you about what your life is all about, I look in the room and I do a quick calculation of how many people are in this room. And I think maybe 300 or 400 people. And then I do some quick statistics in my head, and I realize that by this time next year, roughly four or five of you, according to statistics, four or five of you will be dead by this time next year. Which four or five is it? And don't just look at the old ones. The young ones die too. So this is just statistics. This is what happens. Some of us will die. And it's not just the people with cancer. It's the other people. Usually the ones with cancer survive and live a long life. It's the other ones who die. So what's going on? Why do such things happen? Because it is part of the contract of life that these things happen. You can't escape from it. But you know that sometimes one of the things which is so hard for people to accept is, why is it that young people die? Why do such bad things as like a premature death happen to, say, children or people maybe only 18 or 20, 30? Especially many of you may have gone to the cancer wards for children and seen these little people who haven't had much of a life. That there they are in the ward suffering from cancer. And you think, what did they do to deserve that? So young, without much of a life, and then they die. And this monk in Thailand many years ago told me this incredibly beautiful story. He said that he was meditating in a forest, in a jungle, and his hut was a very simple dwelling made of bamboo and thatch. And one night in the monsoon season, there was a fierce storm, just like the one we just had a few minutes ago, but lasting much longer. The rain came thundering down, the wind was blowing everywhere, and as the storm grew stronger, there were many trees got uprooted. And being great trees in the jungle, they came crashing down onto the jungle floor. You see, whenever I give a talk, you know where you can go asleep. Every now and again, I'm going to scare you with crashing down onto the jungle floor. Bang, they went. Smash, they went. And it was so loud and so dangerous that the poor monk couldn't sleep all night. Not just because of the sound, because he was a bit afraid, because if one tree or one heavy branch fell on top of his hut, he'd be dead. It was only a thatch roof with bamboo for rafters, which would offer no protection at all from even a heavy branch. So he's up all night, hearing the thuds and crashes. And as the dawn came, the storm finished, and he went outside in the early light of morning to see the damage in the forest. And he saw many big trees had fallen to the ground, and many big branches had just missed his hut. He was very lucky to be alive. But it wasn't just the trees and the branches which he noticed. Because of the force of the wind, there were many leaves had been ripped off the trees and lay dead on the forest floor. And he noticed most of the leaves torn off from the tree the night before were the old brown leaves. Leaves which had lived a full life on the twigs and branches and now lay dead on the floor. But amongst those brown leaves, he saw many yellow leaves, many middle-aged leaves, some green leaves, some youngsters were also lying dead on the floor. And amongst those green leaves, he saw a few leaves which were so freshly green, he knew they could only have sprouted forth the day before. Even those very, very baby leaves lay dead on the floor because of the force of the wind. He got what we call in Buddhism an insight, which explains some of the mysteries of life. But to confirm his insight, he looked up at the trees to see what leaves were left. And as you would expect, most of the leaves still clinging to life on the branches and twigs were the green leaves, the young healthy ones. But even though some of those green leaves lay dead, amongst those green leaves on the twigs and branches were many yellow leaves. They had survived and were still alive. And there were many brown leaves as well, curly old brown leaves which still clung on to life even though the young ones had died. And he realized that this is the nature of a storm. The storm takes mostly the old leaves, but it also picks a few middle-aged, young, and even baby leaves. Just like the storms of death, which come through our communities, through our families and friends, it mostly takes the old brown leaves. And there are a few curly old brown leaves in this room this evening. Still alive. And it takes a lot of yellow leaves as well. But it still leaves some yellow leaves, while it takes the young leaves. Old people are left living, while children die. And he realized that this is the nature of life and death. Death is like a storm blowing through our communities. It does take most of the old ones, but it also takes, by nature, young ones too. When we understand that, we understand why it is that young people die. It is just part of being born as a human being. It's not as if something has gone wrong. It is just the nature which we have to accept and live with, because this is the truth of our world. But when these things happen, you know, we think, my goodness, it's a terrible thing which has happened to us. It's a bad thing. And the reason I'm giving this talk is actually to say how we can understand why bad things happen to us, and then what to do about them when they do happen. But before I go even deeper into that, as a Buddhist monk, I sometimes think, is it a bad thing which happened to you? And I'll tell the following story. This is one of my favorite stories of recent times. If you've been listening to me on the internet, you'd have heard this several times in recent months, because it's a great story of the king who was a hunter. Many, many centuries ago, a king went out hunting with his entourage of guards and ministers and who knows what. And as he was out hunting in the forest, he scratched his finger. He cut it. And in his entourage was his doctor. So he called his doctor over and he said, look, I've cut my finger. Is it going to be all right? And his doctor looked at the wound and said, good, bad, who knows? And then he put a band-aid on the wound. When they came back to the palace after the hunt, the wound had got worse. So the king called the doctor over, look at my finger, it's infected. And so the doctor pulled off the band-aid and looked at the wound, and it was infected. So he put some ointment on and then a bandage. And the king said, is it going to be okay? And what did the doctor say? Good, bad, who knows? A few days later, the wound infection was so bad, the doctor had to amputate the finger. And then the king said, you stupid doctor, look what's happened to my finger. All this good, bad, who knows business. I'm going to throw you into jail. So he put the doctor into one of the prison cells, personally. He said, what do you think about that, you stupid doctor? And the doctor said, being in jail? Good, bad, who knows? That's a crazy doctor. And a few weeks later, when the wound has healed, the king was out hunting again, and he was following some animal trying to hunt it, and he got separated from his entourage. And being alone in the jungle, he got captured by the forest people. They captured him and took him to their priest, because it was one of their holy days. And the priest decided to sacrifice him to their god. So they brought him to the clearing in the center of the jungle, and they did all the ceremonials, and they're about to cut off his head as a sacrifice to their god, when the priest noticed. Hold on, he said, this man has only got 9 fingers. He's not perfect enough. Let him go. And so the king was released on the edge of death. And he realized as he walked from the jungle back home, that was a wise doctor. It was good I lost a finger, otherwise now I'd be dead. So as soon as he got back to the palace, he went straight to the prison and he released the doctor, saying, I'm sorry, it was a good thing that I lost my finger, you were right. Otherwise I'd be dead. But it was a bad thing I did to put you in jail. I'm sorry. And the doctor said, what do you mean a bad thing you put me in jail? It was a good thing I was in jail. Look, if I wasn't in jail, I would have been hunting with you. And I've got 10 fingers. So, good, bad, who knows? I mentioned, I think yesterday, last night, when I was only 19, I fell in love. This beautiful girl. And we had all these plans for our future. And then she found another guy and dumped me. Was that good or bad? I know, it's good. Now I can become a monk, it's wonderful, thank you so much. So many are things which happen to you in life. Sometimes you think a bad thing has happened to me. But really you don't know why these things have happened and how that's going to play out in your life. So that's the first thing to remember. When some misfortune or tragedy happens to you, don't call it bad. Say, good, bad, who knows? So when you find out your husband has got a mistress, is that bad? Good, bad, who knows? When you find out you've got cancer.
Good, bad, who knows?
Very good, she's got cancer. But it's true. I have never had cancer, but I've talked to a lot of people who have. I've been counseling them, teaching them meditation, looking after them. And you know, many of these people who have cancer. The first person who told me to this, I thought, you must be crazy. Because they were in remission and they came up to tell me that's the best thing which ever happened to them in their whole life. I said, what? Because cancer treatment is very unpleasant. The radiation therapy burns, the chemotherapy makes you terribly sick, and just the whole thing just changes your whole life as you've got to look after your body, maybe leave your work and look after your body for, you know, a year or two. So what do you mean as the best thing which happened to you in your whole life? And many of the people, that was the first one who told me that, and many hundreds of people have told me that since. They said they learned so much of what's really, really important in life. It was as if it was like the best Dharma talk they'd ever learned. Not sort of sitting down and listening to a funny monk from Australia, but actually listening to life and how to deal with these events in life. They grew so much. They learned how to love. They learned how to be loved. They learned about the most important things in life, which aren't your job, your career, your finances, or your status. That experience of cancer, they said, was a blessing in disguise. And they said that they wouldn't have given up that experience for the whole world. They grew and learned so much. Painful, yes, but so beneficial. To this day, I remember the best teachers I had at school were the ones I didn't like because they pushed me. And they were disciplining me. I never liked them at the time, but I learned so much from them. Same as cancer, you never like it at the time, but you learn so much from it. And all the things which happen to you in life which you think are bad, when you look at them from another direction, especially after a few years, you realize that really taught me so much. I tell this to young people because sometimes the young people, they fall in love. And you know what happens the first time you fall in love, it's very rarely it works out. You have to have broken heart first of all. And when they come up to me with a broken heart, because sometimes they trust me more than their mum or their dad, and they come up and start crying that, you know, it hasn't worked out, all their plans were broken. I tell them what happened to me and say, you may be very lucky, you may become a monk or a nun now. No, I don't. What I usually tell them is, look, You don't know how to love until you've had a broken heart. It's as if that broken heart teaches you just the importance of love and how to really create a relationship. Because without that, we take things far too much for granted. Without the disappointments and difficulties of life, we think that life is so easy that we don't give it any, we don't work at it, we don't make it happen. We just take it for granted and expect life to be sweet and happy. But when things go wrong, it teaches us that, look, this is our nature of life, we have to care for each other. Children die when they're very young. Things go wrong at any time, it's the nature of our life. We don't notice how long we have to live here, to be together. And it's because of that that we really learn the meaning of life. How to care, how to forgive, how to bring happiness in the most simple of events today, not waiting till tomorrow. And if we understand that, we understand when bad things happen to us, just as the Buddha would teach, these are messengers of truth coming to teach us how to live our life. One of my disciples over in Jakarta, he told me once that his boss at work was very upset at him one day. So upset, he called him into the office and took a gun out of the drawer and put it to the guy's head and said, "If you don't resign, I'm going to shoot you." Now that was a pretty fierce boss. And he had no choice. He went home without a job, his career in tatters, and he didn't know how he was going to look after his wife and his kids. But he said afterwards, he said that was one of the most wonderful things that ever happened to him. He realized the only way to survive was start his own business. Working out from scratch, he made a very, very, very successful business, and now his family are financially secure, and he's actually quite a wealthy man. And at the time he told me, because I was staying at his house when I was in Jakarta, he said at the time he thought this was a tragedy happened to him in life, but he realized it was a blessing. It wasn't that bad after all. At the time he thought it was such a tragedy, but later on in perspective, he thought what a wonderful thing that was that happened to him. It got him going in the journey of his life. So that tells us, yes, when these things happen to us, they're very hard to deal with at the time, but good, bad, who knows? It gives us the opportunity to work with the difficulties of life and make something out of them. The simile which I gave, which was in the book Opening the Door of Your Heart, was such an important simile that in the American, the US edition of that book, it became the title story. The American version, the US version of my book is called Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung? And it's got a little truck with a pile of dung on the front cover. If you're going to sell a book in the US, you need to have an edge. And that's the edge of our marketing department in the United States. And that story, which I've used successfully for many, many years, goes like this. It's a simile, a metaphor for real life. It's like you come to a nice talk like this. You have a wonderful evening, and when you go back to your house or your apartment, you find in front of your door a big truckload of the smelliest, dirtiest dung. You know what dung is? Like poo. And there's two things about that pile of dung in front of your own door. Number one, you didn't order it. It's not your fault. That's number one. And number two is your neighbors never saw the truck dumping it. So you don't know who did it. You can't ring up somebody to get them to take it away. It's yours and you're stuck with it. And there's two things which people do with dung which arrives in their house. The first person puts the dung in their pockets, in their bags, up their shirt, down their trousers, and they carry it around with them. You find if you carry around dung in your pockets, you lose a lot of friends. People don't like to associate with you. That's a simile. What that means is when bad things happen to you in life, you get depressed and negative, guilty and angry. You carry the pain around with you. And you lose a lot of friends. Even your best friends. No one likes to be around negative people for too long. They just can't stand it. The other person, when they get a whole truckload of dung in front of their door, they don't carry it around with them. They get out the wheelbarrow and shovel. They put the dung in the wheelbarrow and they carry it around to their garden and they dig it in to their garden. It's tough to do, but it's the only choice. And sometimes it takes months, even years, to take all the dung and dig it into the garden. But day by day, month by month, year by year, the pile of dung gets less and less. And the garden gets more and more flowers and fruits. And after a few years, the great miracle happens. All the dung, the pain has gone. And in its place, you have this amazing garden whose flowers are so fragrant, even passers-by get overwhelmed by the beautiful scent. And you have such amazingly beautiful flowers, you bring them to the temple, offer them to the Buddha, and make immense great karma. And as for the fruit from your mango tree, from your apple tree, whatever fruits you grow in your garden, your mangoes are juicier and sweeter than anything you can get in the marketplace. So you offer it to your friends and also to your favorite monk. And with all the food I get offered, I actually eat that because it's the most delicious. So making sure you get lots of good karma. And you give it to your friends. There's so many juicy fruits. And where did it all come from? The dung. That's why whenever you eat a sweet mango, you must always remember what you're really eating. It all comes from dirty stuff, but it comes out very beautiful, sweet and juicy. You've made use of the bad experience of your life, the truckload of dung. You've dug it in and got a garden. And of course you understand what that simile means. The tragedies and difficulties in your life, which other people would get overwhelmed by, would get negative, depressed, guilty, even commit suicide because of the tragedies and difficulties they feel, not you. You're going to dig it in. It's hard work, but you've got no choice. Anyone who ever thinks of committing suicide, don't. Because if you commit suicide, all you do is kill your body. And after you're dead, you're still there. Your reincarnation, you've still got your problems, only more problems now. You don't escape. You're still there afterwards. So it's not the right thing to do to deal with problems. Instead, it's hard work and no one else can do it for you. You have to put that dung in the wheelbarrow. You have to wheel it round to the garden and dig it in. All other people can do is give you the wheelbarrow and the spade and encourage you. But it's well worthwhile doing. Day after day, week after week, year after year, your problem gets less. And your garden, your heart, grows with the flowers of wisdom and the fruits of compassion. And soon you've got so much wisdom and compassion, You take it to the temple, you share it with your friends, and it's so sweet and juicy and nourishing. And where did your compassion and wisdom come from? It came from the dung, the pain and difficulty which you faced in life, and you dug into your heart. As I said, you can't love if you haven't had a broken heart. You cannot know compassion until you've known pain. You cannot have wisdom until you've actually empathized and touched some of the greatest difficulties which human beings have to face. And then you become wise and compassionate. I noticed that when I was a young monk over in Thailand. There were some monks who were great meditators. They can sit for hours peacefully, but they weren't wise. Their compassion wasn't so warm it could attract lots of people. And I wondered why. Why were they very still and they understood, but they couldn't convey that wisdom? They didn't have that compassion and that wisdom which they could share with others. They could be peaceful themselves. And when I asked them about their life, I realized that this was the reason. There were some monks who had such a nice, easy life. And because of the ease and lack of difficulty and trouble they had in their life, they had an easy path to enlightenment, but they had so little dung to dig in. Their garden had very few flowers of wisdom and fruits of compassion. And other monks had such a difficult time, had to struggle so hard. They had so much dung in their life, but they dug it in, they made it, and their garden was incredibly beautiful. So much wisdom, so much compassion. So remember, when bad things happen to you in life, they aren't tragedies, they are opportunities. They are chances to understand what the Buddha understood in a very powerful, deep way, so you can become kinder and wiser. I've told this story in Australia a few times. Maybe I'm taking a chance to tell it here because maybe the lady is here. But I don't think she will mind. I hope not. A few years ago, when I was here in Malaysia, I was teaching at the BGF, the Buddhist Gem Fellowship, over in PJ. And every now and again, you know, I teach and I ask, answer questions on meditation. There are always some people who really need some counseling. Now, please don't always come to get counseling from me. There's too many of you, and there's only one of me. And look, I could spend all day and night counseling you. But this was a special case because this lady had been to other counselors and no one was able to help her. So it's one of those cases that I was the last resort. Not the first resort, but the last resort. So obviously, you know, I'd accept. I'll do whatever I can, even if I'm tired. So they brought her into a room and they never told me what the problem was. And that was actually very helpful. Because if I'd known what the problem was, I'd probably say, look, I can't deal with this. So when she came in, number one, I realized that no one else had been able to help. So I realized that all usual techniques would be hopeless. Other people would have tried those already. So I had to make my mind totally free and blank of all ideas of what I should do. And then sat her in front of me and asked her and got out what happened to her. This lady had been violently raped. Violently. It's bad enough being raped, but what she went through, you wouldn't want anyone to go through in any life. And when she told me what had happened, what I did was make my mind as peaceful and compassionate as I possibly could. And when I spoke, I could not believe the words which came out of my mouth. I said, you're very fortunate to have been raped in such a way. Now, as a monk, if I get into those situations of counseling, I totally disappear and allow these words to come out by themselves. It's like you don't do it, they just fall out. And she, her jaw dropped, because she had never heard that before, that it was fortunate. And then I understood what I said. I understood where it came from. And I gave her the simile of the truckload of dung. And I said that the reason I said that was because somehow I had seen inside of you that you have such strong inner resources, that you will, I know this, be able to find a way through that trauma. I can't tell you that way out. I don't know how you feel. I never will be able to know how you feel. I'm a man. I've never been raped. I can't say to you, I know how you feel. But I know that you'll find a way out. And when you have found the way out, the reason why you're fortunate is because you have such an amazing garden that you and no one else will be able to sit in front of a person who's been raped like I'm doing right now. And you'll be able to say with 100% sincerity, I know how you feel. And you'll be able to add that extra, and I know the way out. You'll be able to hold the people's hands in that terrible black space, that space of such great inner hurt, there's a pain which you just cannot contemplate. You'll know how to lead that other person out. That is why you're fortunate, because you can help. Help in a big way where others can't. How fortunate you are. She understood. It sort of gave a meaning, a hope, a path forward out of that terrible experience. I don't know if she is here, but if she is here, I'd really love to know how you're going. And I hope I was correct, and you now are spending your life helping rape victims in a such a beautiful and effective way, in a way which I will never be able to do. That's why I said it was a wonderful and fortunate thing that you had that experience. Now that is a very extreme, painful experience. But you can see it's very moving. It's a bad thing which happens to a good person. They didn't deserve that, but there it was. A great truckload of dung which he didn't order, but I told her, yes, start digging it in, because it's worthwhile. It will empower you with such wisdom and compassion that you will be a tremendously effective person. And of course, you know other people who have walked such a similar path. Obviously, we talk about people like Nelson Mandela. 26 years, I think, he was in jail. He wasn't a bad person to be put in jail with hard labor for such a long time. But with all that bad experience he had, what did he do with it? He learned and grew and became so wise that when he was released from jail and became the president of South Africa, he managed to use everything he'd learned from that terrible experience to unite a country which should have gone to war. A civil war between the blacks and the whites. They didn't. They managed to forge together that rainbow coalition, which is still holding together, not perfectly, but still there. And I think everybody realizes it was one man above all kept that country in harmony and saved so much violence, so much death, and so many tears. And why did he do that? How did he do that? He had 26 years of dung to dig in. And instead of getting negative and wanting to find revenge against the people who had done this to him, instead of seeking revenge, he had a garden of wisdom, compassion and forgiveness which he could share with the people of his nation. And that's why he became a great man. So whatever bad thing happens to you, don't just get negative. There's always something you can do. a story. Once there was a donkey, and the donkey was minding its own business, chewing this, eating that, as donkey was wandering in the forest. But because he wasn't a Buddhist donkey, he wasn't mindful. He was not watching where he was going. He fell into a well. But fortunately, the well was dry, so he didn't drown. But he was stuck in the bottom of a well, and donkeys are not good at climbing out of holes. In fact, it was impossible for him to get out. So there he was, in the bottom of a well, stuck. So what did he do? The only thing which a donkey could do, he started shouting and crying, "Ee-oh! Ee-oh! Ee-oh!" That's apparently what donkeys say. "Ee-oh! Ee-oh! Ee-oh!" Trying to get somebody's attention. And he's going "Ee-oh" for such a long time. He's almost going "Ee-horse." He's got a horse. But finally, after an hour of "Ee-oh-ing," an old farmer found him. He heard this strange sound, and out of curiosity, wondered what was making this stupid sound, and he found on the bottom of the well the old donkey. Now that farmer, he wasn't a Buddhist either. He was a really bad man, that farmer. He never liked that donkey, because the donkey was always chewing his cabbages and his carrots, eating them all. And so the farmer said, "Serves you right, stupid donkey. You've fallen in this well." But he said, "But this is a dangerous well. Not only donkeys, but people and children can fall in this well. I should do something about this." "I know what to do," said the farmer. "I'm going to fill in this well with the donkey in the bottom. That way I can get rid of the donkey by burying him alive and get rid of the dangerous well." So this very bad farmer got out a spade and started digging the earth and throwing it in the well. And the donkey couldn't understand what was going on. "Why is the farmer not saving me? Why is he throwing all this dirt all over me?" And then the donkey figured out what was going on. This bad farmer was burying him alive. So the donkey went, "Ee-oh, ee-oh, ee-oh," which in donkey language means, "Don't do that." And did that stop the bad farmer? No, that made the bad farmer shovel the soil even more fast. "Ee-oh, ee-oh, ee-oh." And then suddenly the donkey went quiet. And the farmer was surprised. He thought he hadn't shoveled that much earth in. He thought, "Good. Donkey is buried now, so I can shovel slowly. The donkey is dead. Ha ha ha. Serve you right, donkey." But was the donkey dead? No. Donkey had what we call in Buddhism insight. A vipassana. Because the donkey realized a great wisdom. Instead of complaining when bad things happen to you, make use of the bad things. So what the donkey did, the next shovelful of earth which landed on top of his back, he just shook it off, stamped it in, and he was 1 centimeter higher. Another shovelful of earth, shake it off, stamp it in, oops. And it was another centimeter higher. And the farmer didn't know what was going on. Another shovelful of earth, another centimeter higher. He was shoveling the earth. He never noticed a pair of donkey ears appear above the top of the well. He never noticed a whole donkey head appear. stamp it in another centimetre higher, until the donkey was so close to the top of the well, he just jumped out, and apparently he bit the farmer on the backside just to teach him the law of karma. And ran away. And the moral of that story is, in life, you know, that's what it's like in life. People slander you. People say all wrong things and bad things about you. It's like they shovel dirt all over you. And it's like in politics. You know, people always like shoveling dirt over politicians, or shoveling dirt over famous people. Sometimes shoveling dirt over you, saying bad things about you. So when people say bad things about you, what should you do? Shake it off. Stamp it in, and you're 1 inch higher every time. So that story tells you what to do when people say bad things about you. You can always just become wiser. I heard this story when I was first year in Thailand. Because I became a monk in 1974, and the Vietnam War was still on at that time. And so very close to Ubon, where Ajahn Chah's monasteries were, was a US Air Force base. And in that US Air Force base were obviously many soldiers. And obviously the soldiers would every now and again go from the base into town. On this one occasion, there was an Afro-American soldier, a very big guy, and he was traveling from the base into town on a cycle rickshaw. Remember those old rickshaws we used to have even in KL with somebody with a bicycle in front? So he was sitting in the back, and the driver was cycling into town. And halfway on the journey, they passed a roadside bar, you know, selling this Mekong whiskey. And many of the driver's friends were there, drinking and becoming a bit inebriated, a bit drunk. Because they had to be drunk to explain what they did next. They pointed to that Afro-American soldier and they said, "Where are you taking that dirty man to?" That dirty dog, he said, because he was a black Afro-American. Now, that was fighting language. Some of those American soldiers had learnt Thai. And the driver thought, if that soldier in the back understands, he's not going to stand for that, he's going to have a fight. And he's a big guy, there'll be blood, there'll be broken bones. So the driver was very scared. And he looked behind at his passenger, who'd just been insulted, racially insulted, called a black dog. And that soldier was smiling, just looking at the beautiful scenery. He obviously could not understand Thai. So the driver decided to have a joke as well. "Look how dirty is this dog. I'm going to take him into town and throw him in the river for a big wash." Ha ha ha, they all laughed. And as far as the soldier was concerned, he just was looking at the scenery, smiling. When they got to town, the soldier got out of the rickshaw and started walking away. He'd forgot to pay. So the driver shouted after him, "Sir, dollars, no fare, you haven't paid." At which the soldier turned around and said, in fluent Thai, "Dogs don't have money." Which is true. Have you ever seen a dog with money? So he didn't have to pay. Now that's how we deal with criticism. If somebody calls you a dog, you don't have to pay anymore. So whenever a bad thing happens to you, like unwarranted criticism, unfair words, don't have to get upset about it. When bad things happen to you, shake it off, tread it in, but an inch higher, they call you a dog, great, I don't have to pay. And that way, you find you have a beautiful way of dealing with the so-called bad things which happen to you in life. And it does become that way. Good, bad, who knows? I don't know how many people, again, you've had a relationship and your husband has played around outside and you get divorced. Good riddance. Which means that you can find another guy who this time is much better than that other scallywag you just got rid of. And at the time, you know, it's very difficult, isn't it? At the time, it's so painful. But afterwards, you realize you're well rid of somebody who was causing you so much pain. This happens sometimes. Great difficulties arise. Sometimes I know that there's some kids who've got into trouble. Sometimes they've got into trouble with drugs. And they've been caught. And they've been put into prison. And sometimes I've been to meet those kids in jail. And sometimes they tell me that needed that. They needed that big kick up the backside to realize what they were doing, to give them another chance. I remember reading this story in a magazine. It was very, very inspiring. There was this young man in Los Angeles. Not a young man, he was a young boy apparently. And as a young boy, his parents were very, very abusive, beating him, not really feeding him. So he ran away, believe it or not, when he was 6 years of age. And he lived on the streets of LA. He was obviously a very, very resourceful boy because he was a survivor. But he managed, obviously, having no family, no real education. He survived, but obviously getting first into petty crime and then into bigger crime. And so he became one of these lifetime criminals. And at his last time in jail, he may be in his early 50s, he had a case officer assigned to him because he was about to be paroled. And she was trying to find a job for him. But how can you find a job for someone who's been in jail for most of their life, who hasn't got much of a education except in crime? And the parole officer was trying to think, what can I do to help this guy? Because if he doesn't get a job, he'll be back in jail within a month. But this was Los Angeles. And this lady had a friend who knew a friend who knew a friend who was shooting a new movie. He was one of these budding directors. And this new director, he wanted to do a crime movie which was authentic. So this case officer went to see this director who was unknown and said, I've got this guy who's been a career criminal. How about making him a consultant on the film? So he can tell you how real criminals speak. Not Brad Pitts and Bruce Willis, but real criminals. And he can show you how they act. He can be the consultant because he's a career criminal. He's an expert. So it just happened, his parole just fat into the shooting schedule. So the director interviewed him, was impressed, gave him a job, was even more, as a consultant, was even more impressed, gave him a part in the film. And he became one of the stars in the film, Reservoir Dogs, because that director was Quentin Tarantino. That was his first breakthrough movie. And this career criminal made so much money just on that one film that after 6 months out of jail, he was living in a mansion in Beverly Hills, paid for with real money. And apparently he married that case officer, who was a beautiful Swedish girl. And he wrote this article, How Strange Life Is. There I was, in prison, with no hope at all. And 6 months later, maybe a year later, I'm living in a mansion with a beautiful wife with more money than I know how to deal with. And why was that? Because he used the dung of his life and he managed to create a garden in only about 12 months to use the experiences we have in life. Now that's an extreme case, but it can happen. So whatever happens to you in your life, you know, you've been in jail for most of your life. or something terrible happens to you, like a cancer, or you lose all your money in the stock market, or everything all goes wrong. There's always something you can do. And as a very, very last resort, you can always become a monk, like me. Or a nun. We've got nuns now. And all these terrible things which happen to you, you can become enlightened. Just like Angulimala and Patachara, for those of you who know your Buddhism. Angulimala, a serial killer. He had no choice, as either become a monk or go to jail, probably get executed. So he became a monk and became enlightened very quickly. So even if it's such bad things happen to you like that, there's still a chance. I want to sort of send a copy of this talk to Osama bin Laden. He too can become... Or Patachara. Her story was she lost her two children, her husband and her parents on the very same day. Now, imagine the grief of losing one close family member. Imagine everybody in your family being destroyed in the same day. And how would you cope? She just lost her mind. She went crazy. She was so mad, she was wandering around and lost all her clothes. So she came into the monastery totally naked. Now if that happened here, what would you do? Would you say, come in, or would you say, Ajahn Brahm, close your eyes? Now what the Buddha did, he said, let her come in. One of you monks, give her your robe to cover her. And because the Buddha was so kind and calm, he managed to calm her craziness, teach her some Dhamma, especially about how to let go, especially of those people you care for. It's a bad thing happened to you, but please make a garden out of it. And she did. And Patachara became one of the great arahats, the great enlightened nuns in the time of the Buddha. And I really respect her immensely, because when I read, anyone who wants to get inspired, you can read the stories of the enlightened monks and nuns in the time of the Buddha. And as I was reading these many, many years ago for the first time, I came across all these nuns in the time of the Buddha who had been meditating and listening to Dhamma for so many years. And they all said the same thing. And then a great teacher came, taught us meditation and Dhamma, and then we became enlightened. Enlightened nun after enlightened nun said the same thing. And that teacher was Patachara. She was one of the best teachers. And the reason why she could teach so powerfully and get people enlightened, fully enlightened, was because of her experience. Such a bad thing happened to her. It was so painful that meant she was one of the most resourceful and strong and wise and compassionate teachers. And it was her experience gave her the power to teach so amazingly effectively that she, more than any other nun, could make people enlightened. So when bad things happen to you, they're blessings in disguise. They're opportunities, ways you can grow and get more compassion and wisdom. The worse it is, it's as if life gives you those tough lessons because it knows you can handle it. You don't like it, but you've got no choice. Handle it. Grow the flowers, grow the trees, and you'll find not only yourself, but countless beings benefit. So good, bad, I know both are good. Thank you for listening. Okay, now we do have some questions which are on the table over here. So I'll just go through these ones first of all, and then we'll see what happens afterwards. So questions from the floor. The first question was actually from last night. I never got through it. Last night's talk was surviving relationships, and this is one of those extreme cases. Never get yourself in this situation. What's your advice for this story? A married man in his late 50s started adultery by having a baby with a mistress whom the relationship is less than 2 years old. And yet this man still wants to keep his legal wife and family, and at the same time attend to this second extended family. The reason is he's doing this for the sake of his duty to be a responsible father and his karma. Please tell me how to survive this relationship. Obviously, whoever that guy is not exactly a very good husband. In fact, he's a very bad person. He's made big mistakes. And the proper thing to do for him would be actually to ask forgiveness of his wife. He still has to obviously financially maintain his son by his mistress, but he should really abandon his mistress, because that's a really wrong thing to do. But that wasn't the question. How does the wife survive that? You've had a big truckload of dung, and it's very difficult to know what to do. But depending on your circumstances, if you've got your husband, but you've also got other children, and you really think it's in their interest to stick with that man and to show that, yes, you can just forgive and you can live with people even though they've hurt you very badly and you've done nothing wrong, if you can actually rise to that occasion, wonderful, do it. Without blame, without guilt, let the past go and look for the benefits of the future. If that's in your interest and your family's interest, your children's interest, then carry on. And don't feel guilty. Your husband, that scallywag, he'll get his karmic juice. But if you find that that's not a good thing to do, and then you really feel you need to separate, don't feel guilty. You've got a good excuse for that. Know that separation is painful, but if your children are grown up, talk it over with your kids, and if they agree that's the best thing to do, then fine. Whatever happens, it's not your fault. A bad thing has happened to you, but you can learn from that experience. You can grow in forgiveness and compassion and wisdom. Don't get negative. Don't get angry. Don't get guilty. If you do, you're not digging in the dung. You're just carrying around with you. Next question. My questions are, what do you think in your opinion that made your father to say those words which became more famous by now? Whatever you do or whatever you become, the door of my house is always open to you. I say to you, thank you for that question, because when I was young, my paternal grandfather just didn't exist. Now, I knew he died in Liverpool because my father came from Liverpool. And my father would never talk about his father, my paternal grandfather. And I always wondered why, until one time, I must have been about 14, I confronted my dad and said, why don't you ever talk about your dad, my grandfather? And so I think my father felt I was old enough now to understand. So please excuse this language, but this is actually what my father said. He said, because my father, your grandfather, was a bastard. That's what he said. I thought, good grief. Why are you talking about your father like that? And then he explained. He said, my paternal grandfather was a plumber. And this was a time of the Great Depression in England, where work was very hard to get. And my grandfather coped by taking whatever money he'd earned, going down to the pub and getting drunk every night. And when he would come home drunk every night, he'd take off his leather belt and he'd whip any kid who came within reach and then start beating his wife. And that was my father's mother, my grandma, who I never knew. He said he was such a violent, cruel man, he could never love him. But, said my father, whenever I was on the end of that whip, however much it hurt, he said, I made this promise to myself. If ever I have kids, I will never spank them. I will never hit them. And he never did. He had that bad experience of domestic violence. And he, because of that experience, some psychologists say that you will do the same which you received on your children. But he never did. He learned from that experience. That was his truckload of dung. And he dug that in and he became one of the most compassionate and kind men I ever knew. That's why he'd experienced the opposite of a violent father who not only beat him, but beat the mother he loved. Instead of becoming violent back, he became kind. That was his truckload of dung, and he dug that in very well, and he had a beautiful garden, and I was very fortunate to have him as a father. That's where his kindness came from the pain of his upbringing during the poverty of the Great Depression in Liverpool. Next question. What was your mother's reaction when you first disclosed your thoughts of becoming a monk? Did she accept your idea easily? In my life, I was always a very responsible kid. And you know, even though that, you know, it was a very poor family, and I always got these scholarships all the time, like, you know, from primary school. In my primary school, it was a poor suburb of London, had all these migrant kids. So like any other sort of place, the migrants go to the poor suburbs because that's all they can afford. So they had kids from Pakistan, from the Caribbean, from Eastern Europe, and these were my friends. So just this really very simple school. But I always did very well at school, and so I got a scholarship from the primary school to a very good secondary school. And from there I got a scholarship to Cambridge. So scholarships all the way, because no way could my family afford such a great education. And so because I was always responsible and always good, it meant that when I asked my mother, I want to become a monk, she said, I trust you, because you've been proven for those 23 years of your life to be a most responsible son. You've never made mistakes. If you come home late, you've always given me a call because you don't want me to get worried. He said, because of the way you've lived your life for 23 years, I trust your decision. I earned that trust. So if there's any kids here, if you are good to your parents when you're young and you always think about them and how your actions affect them, and you're responsible, it means that when you get to 23 and 24 and you make a decision about your life, your parents are more likely to accept that decision simply because you've earned their trust. So she said, I don't understand why you want to become a monk, but if that's what you want to do, it must be a good idea because you've already made good choices in your life. But you know what she said, being a mother, and many mothers here could understand this, she said, I don't mind you being a monk, but can't you become a monk next door so I can keep visiting you? Why do you have to become a monk so far away? So as being so far away was the thing she didn't like. No, it's a separation. Even if I was going to get married, you know, to sort of a Thai girl or a Malaysian girl, she'd have still been so disappointed. Why can't you get married to someone next door so I can go and visit you? And now you all know that one of our rules as a monk is we can't actually come into physical contact with a woman. And that was so hard for my mother. She said, I can't hug and kiss you. I said, it's against the rules. She said, that's unfair. And she had a point. So I told her I'd make a rule that whenever I went to visit her, you know, from Thailand or from wherever, she was allowed one hug and a kiss at the airport when she met me, and one hug and a kiss where we departed. But I always made sure there was no Thai people watching because I might get into trouble. Because it's mothers, they can't stop hugging their kids. So even that was hard for my mum, but she was a great mum. So what is your comment on the Dutanga bhikkhus? In your opinion, are they in the middle path or are they in the extremes? Okay, for the Dutanga monks, they're the monks who actually live quite simply. And I spent many, many years, I still do many, many things like a Dutanga monk. I usually sleep on the floor, even though you should see the bed I've got in my room. It's such a huge bed. But I just sleep on the floor instead. I remember doing that, that I was at this conference over in Cambodia, and they put me up in this nice hotel room, but then I didn't sleep on the bed, I just slept on the floor. And then the maid came in the morning to do, you know, the housekeeping, and she saw my stuff on the floor, and she looked at me, she looked on the bed, and she walked out. I thought, so I was crazy. But no, I still keep many of those rules. It's just for simplicity. So for the Dutanga practices, it's doing things like sleeping in a cemetery. And I love sleeping in cemeteries. When I was in Thailand, they said that's the only place you can go at night when no one will disturb you. Otherwise, all these people will come and ask you questions. And that's what happened. You know, when I was wandering in Thailand, sort of this Dutanga monk, you'd wander from place to place, and you'd sit down under a tree to meditate. And within 5 minutes, I remember this one case, this woman came, and she had a bottle of Pepsi Cola, a piece of paper, and a pencil. That's right, it was lottery numbers. And if you didn't write the number on the piece of paper, you'd take away the bottle of Pepsi. And they just kept bothering you about these numbers all the time. So the only place you go in the cemetery, and you can meditate there. No person would dare come in. So that was a great place. So I love the cemeteries. They're very peaceful places. So yeah, those were Dutanga practices. But the point is, you find a middle way. If you're very young, those young monks, because as a young monk, you do have a lot of lust. It's your hormones in the body. So sometimes you do need to be a bit more extreme. You know, just not sort of eating too much, eating very simple food. And I used to do that when I was a young monk. And so I know, I've been there and done that. I know exactly how it works. And it's a very good practice when you're young, as long as it doesn't make you sick. So you've got to find that middle way. And I still keep many of those practices and keep it very simple. You know, like eating in my bowl. Over here I don't cut being my bowl, but those who visited the monastery, everything goes in the bowl. So, you know, sometimes you've got a bowl, and sometimes you can't help but things get mixed up. Many, many, many times I've had custard on curry. I've had ice cream on spaghetti. Chocolate ice cream melting in the spaghetti. Because it's all in one bowl. But look, you know, it gets mixed up in your tummy anyway, doesn't it? So just mix it up outside, first of all. Is that disgusting, having ice cream on spaghetti? How many of you have had ice cream on spaghetti? How do you know it's disgusting? But it is disgusting. I know, I've done it. So that's the Dutanga practice. But, you know, if you're young, you can do that. Sometimes now you do that. But if it's going to cause you tummy ache, then you don't do it. If it's going to cause you sickness, then you don't do it. So you find a middle way so you can let go of your cravings without causing you illness. And that's the Dutanga. So sometimes it's okay. Since I have a blocked nose, I used to take deep breath instead of breathe normally. Is it okay? Now, obviously, here you say you've got a blocked nose, but you take a deep breath instead of breathing normally. So just breathe normally, however normal happens to be for you. If you've got a blocked nose, you're breathing somewhere, otherwise you're dead. So however it is you're breathing, you know, even when you're not meditating, the way you breathe when you're not meditating, that's the way you breathe when you are meditating. And you just watch that. Doesn't matter where the breath is, you just watch it there. So sometimes people think they have to watch the breath of the tip of the nose. Those of you who meditate and watch the breath of the tip of the nose, do you sometimes lose the breath? Yes, you do. You know why? Because the breath's not there. It's somewhere else. Just like today, I'm sure that many people went to my monastery in Perth looking for me. I'm supposed to be in my monastery in Perth, but I'm not because I'm here. So they came looking for me in the wrong place, and they never found me. Just like if you try and watch the breath here, and it's not here, you don't find it. The breath is somewhere, again, otherwise you're dead. So you know you're not dead. The breath must be going in and out somewhere. So find out where the breath happens to be and follow it there. You follow the breath, not follow your nose. Question two, for those who do not believe in karma and Buddhism, how can we convince these good people will have bad encounters due to their karma in the past life? You know that over in the West now, I've noticed in the time I've been a monk, now people actually use the word karma. You know, if something bad happens to them, they said, this must be my karma. And I think someone told me there was a program called Earl or something, The Life of Earl. Earl or something. Oh, my name is Earl. And apparently the story was this guy Earl had done such bad karma in his life and he spent every episode trying to fix his bad karma. And I mean, that's Buddhist. So there you go, like a TV series is based on Buddhist principles. So a lot of time now, at least people believe in karma. Even they may not believe in Buddhism, but most Westerners now believe in karma. There's some justice in the world. So even if you don't get caught by the police, karma police will get you. And this was one of the guys I met in prison, because I used to do a lot teaching in prison. And after teaching this guy many, many weeks, and he was one of these old Australian prisoners, maybe in his late 40s or early 50s. He wanted a personal interview with me after the class of meditation. So I gave him that interview and he said, Ajahn Brahm, I'm innocent. I was put in jail for a crime I did not commit. And he said, look, I know everybody says this in jail, but I respect you. I'm being honest. I didn't do that burglary. And I can understand people from their bodily expression. You don't need a lie detector. I can suss you out pretty quickly. I should be working for the CIA. And I knew he was telling the truth. But I also knew in prison you have very few opportunities to undo wrongs. You can't contact lawyers. You've got no money. So what could he do to correct that injustice? Very little, but I could do something. So I thought, I can't let this happen. And I started thinking of some lawyers I knew, people I could talk to, some ministers in the government I could approach to get this injustice overturned. And when I was thinking of what I would do once I get out of that jail and go back to monastery, he interrupted my thoughts. He smiled and he said, but Ajahn Brahm, even though I didn't do that burglary, I've done so many other burglaries where I wasn't caught, I guess it's karma. And even he understood karma much better than I did. So how many times have you got away with things and haven't been caught? How many times have you not put the income in your tax return? How many times you've been speeding and the police haven't caught you? How many times have you done wrong things and got away with it? It's catching up on you. Karma is coming, be careful. One of these stories which I loved was of a long time ago, this was a teacher. And he had a number of students, maybe a dozen students. This was in India a long time ago. This is an Indian story. It's a great story to tell your kids. And he had a daughter, a very beautiful girl. And the daughter was getting to that age where she had to get married. In those days, the father had to arrange the marriage. And so one day, he called all his students together. And he said, it's about time I married my daughter. And it's our custom to marry my daughter to one of my students, that's one of you boys. I know she's very beautiful, and many of you would love to marry her. And I don't know how to make that choice, which one of you deserves my daughter. So I'm going to give you a test. A test to see how wise and obedient you are. And the one who wins the test will win my daughter. But also, I have a problem. I'm very poor. So I've designed this test to solve my two problems, who will marry my daughter, and how I can get enough money to pay your dowry and Tati to set you up in your first house. What I want you to do, students, I want you to go into the villages surrounding this place in the middle of the night. I want you to crawl or break into the houses and steal. Whatever you steal, we'll put together and give to my daughter and whoever marries her. And whoever steals the most will win my daughter. But make sure that no one sees you when you're stealing. And the students were shocked. They thought the teacher was a good person. And now the teacher was telling the students to steal. But their obedience was so strong, they literally had no choice. So for the next week, they went into the village late at night. Either when the owners were asleep or when they're out, they crawled in through the window or through the roof or open doors, and they stole whatever they could. And when they brought them back to their teacher, the teacher would keep meticulous notes of what they were and what the item was from which house and which student stole them. And at the end of the week, the teacher called all the students together. And he said, I'm now about to make the announcement, who's won the test. But I must say that you've all been very obedient and very smart. You've stolen so much stuff, it's enough to set up the happy couple in luxury. You've all stolen a lot, except one of you, students. And his poor young boy hung his head in shame. Why didn't you steal? Why didn't you follow my instructions? Said the teacher. And the boy put his head up and said, but I did follow your instructions. Then why didn't you steal anything? It was because, said the student, I crawled into the houses when the occupants were away. Or I crawled in when they were asleep and unconscious. And I was about to pick something up, but I realized you told me not to steal if someone was watching. Who was watching? Said the teacher. I was watching, said the student. I was watching me steal, therefore I couldn't take anything. Ah, said the teacher, thank goodness I've got one wise student amongst you stupid scallywags. You have passed the test. Now all you other students, take the goods back to the village. No, they will beat us and put in prison. No, they won't. I told all the villagers beforehand to expect you. They were pretending to be asleep. They pretended to leave their doors open. They won't punish you at all. Take it all back. I'm more than rich enough. I just wanted to test the wisdom of my students. And only one has passed. He knows whenever you do anything wrong, there's always someone looking. You are. That's why you can never get away with doing anything wrong. If you think you can commit adultery and no one sees you, you see you doing adultery. If you think you can steal and get away with it, no, you see yourself steal. So that's why there's always someone watching. You are. And so the student who was wise married the beautiful girl. They were rich and they lived happily ever after. If a wife cares for a husband who is workaholic and depressed, he still has no time to show care for his wife. How can a wife balance herself? Okay, look. Get your husband to come to a talk like this. Do some meditation. And then he will realize being a workaholic and depressed is no way to live a life. If your husband won't come, try this. Buddhist psychology. This has happened many times, but the first time this happened, there was a Malaysian girl in Perth. She was married to an Australian guy. And she'd come to my talks and meditation. She got so much out of it. And she kept on trying to ask her husband, why didn't you come to the temple? And it's not boring, it's interesting, it's fun, the monk tells jokes, and it's also, it's very good for us. I become so much wiser and kinder afterwards. No, that's rubbish, all that religion. That's superstition. And the Australian would not come. So she came to me, how can I get my husband to come to the temple? I said, it's easy. Just ordinary psychology of marriage. I know this and I'm a monk. Look, get a copy of my book, Open the Door of Your Heart. Take it home with you. And when you go into the house, in the home, tell your husband, keep your hands off this. This is mine. So that's what she did. She said to her husband, keep your hands off this. This is my book. And the next day when she was out shopping, of course, what does the husband do? What does he mean, her book? So he opened it up, he read it, and he couldn't put it down till he finished. Now he comes to my monastery every week. So you psychology, get a Buddhist tape and tell your husband, don't you dare look at this. I better keep it going. Goodness, wow, there's three questions here. Number one, ever since I am young, I frequently suffer from anxiety attack. As a result, I often avoid social situations of being the centre of attention. It has affected my life to the point that I find myself becoming quite dysfunctional at times and don't feel confident doing anything in life. Please help me. At least you'll ask a question. So I think I'm doing Beyond Anxiety in a talk in 2 or 3 days' time. So because there's many questions, I'm going to defer that question. Please come with us on Thursday night. Wednesday night. Yes, come on Wednesday. How do we find meaning and purpose in life? I've been asking myself the question for over 10 years, but I've yet to come a satisfactory answer. Not being able to find out the answer often leads to the feelings of hopelessness and depression. Should I continue asking myself this question? Don't ask the question. Do something about it to find meaning in life. So if you haven't got a relationship with someone yet, a partner in life, because that gives you a lot of meaning. If you have kids, that gives you huge amounts of meaning. Go and do some community work. Go and sort of serve in like an old people's home. There are many, many people who are old. Their children are either too busy or they're far away and they can't really look after them. Especially this time of the year, Christmas and New Year, maybe Chinese New Year. Go out and serve. Whether it's an old people's home or just helping an orphanage, even if it's just sweeping the floors. Or if it's going teaching, giving talks to kids. There's this one woman I heard about from the United States, depressed, anxiety disorder, and cancer, only a few months to live. She was a real mess. And a counselor told her, but go and do something. Why don't you go into the burns units in the children's wards and read stories to the kids? Because when a child is badly burned, they had to go into these units where, because of the risk of infection, these were sterile areas where the children could not leave for months on end until their burns were healed well enough that they could be safe from infections. So they're stuck in these little prisons where the doctors and nurses are trying their best to be kind, but they need all the help they can get. So this woman organized herself and her friends to go into these children wards. They had to scrub up and wear these suits and read stories to the kids. The kids loved being read stories to, but no, not as much as the people loved reading the stories to the children. She found her meaning in life by helping others. That was innovative. There's so much community service you can do in our modern world. We are so busy that usually where a family would look after the weaker members, now we're too busy. So we have homes and institutions. Please, whoever wrote this question, find a place where you can do some service. And then you'll find your meaning in life. I've been contemplating monkhood for many years. I wish to find out if it is really my calling in life. What does it take to become a monk? Just shave your hair, come and see me. Yeah, we're doing tonight. Now look, How many doctors and nurses and dentists, husbands and wives have we got? We've got heaps. And how many monks have you got here in Malaysia? So few, you have to import them from Australia. So you need homegrown monks. So just do it. Can you also please share with us your reasons for renunciation? What brought you to Thailand? How you encountered Ajahn Chah? Why do you remain as a monk? Because I wanted to do a career which fulfilled two purposes. It had to make me happy and had to be able to give happiness to others. So whatever career I wanted, it had to be personally fulfilling, but also had to serve the community. And look what I'm doing now. I'm so happy as a monk, and I'm making a difference in the world. Really helping and serving make a better world to thousands of people. I'm so fulfilled in my current role as a monk. You could do the same. You can make far more difference as a spiritual leader than as a doctor or a lawyer. Even great doctors, they heal people, but they die anyway. When I heal people, they're healed for many, many lives. So it's very powerful being a monk or a nun. So, whoever wrote that question, if your parents are in the audience, or any parents here, and your son or daughter says, I want to become a monk or a nun, if you say no, you're making very bad karma. You're stopping a great teacher helping the world. I remember telling this to the chief reverend before he passed away. In Malaysia, Chinese Buddhists are so inspired and happy when somebody becomes a monk, as long as it's not their son. So it really is a wonderful career and a beautiful thing to do. So if your child says he wants to become a monk or nun, and they're really serious about it, then let them do it. You'll be very proud of them, and they'll be doing a great service to the world, and your whole family will benefit. However, being the only son in the family, I feel that I may have to forego this intention. In the Chinese culture, it is the duty of the eldest son in the family to take care of his aging parents. If I were to become a monk, I'm afraid that I may not be able to fulfill my filial responsibilities and be seen as an ungrateful child. You can take care of your ill parents as a monk. Ajahn Chah looked after his ill mother for many, many years. In fact, now my mother now has dementia, and she's in a nursing home in UK. And already that people probably next week are visiting her on my behalf. My disciples, my students, so we realize that you're far away, so we're going to visit your mother for you. So when you're a good monk, your filial duties are performed much more than you can ever do by yourself. So please become a monk, even if you're the only son, and you'll be able to look after your parents in a way you can never be able to do if you were just in the world. You'd be really able to look after them, big time. So it's a wonderful filial thing to do. Look at the Buddha. He was the only son as well. He looked after his parents so well, especially his father. In a sitting meditation, the thought of scolding others, criticizing others, some unwholesome related thoughts arises. Should I be kind with it to practice loving kindness to whom the mind is reacting with negativity, etc.? Yeah, what they mean, they're meditating here and they have these thoughts. That stupid person sitting next to me coughing, and I was just about to get into jhana. Why do they do that? They're always making a noise. I'm going to tell their name to Ajahn Brahm. They're blacklisted, so they won't be able to come up to the next retreat. Now, remember, this is a great saying, and it applies to everybody here. If somebody is causing you a noise, causing you a problem, because they make a noise, it's not the noise disturbs you, it's you who disturb the noise. They're not disturbing you, you're disturbing them. So people make noise. Dogs bark, that's their nature. Women nag, husbands scold, kids misbehave, that's their nature. So, understanding human nature, you realize when you have 120, 140 people in a room, someone is going to make a noise. So trying to scold them is a total waste of time. They make the noise, and when they finish, let it go. If you say, why did they speak? They're not allowed to speak. This is supposed to be noble silence. You have now disturbed your quietness three times. Every time you scold, you're disturbing yourself. So let it go straight away. If you let it go straight away, there's no problem. They've misbehaved, they've broken the rules, but you haven't broken the rules. Why do you suffer? Because of what they did. So let it go, for goodness sake. Please tell us how to uproot the five hindrances. If we meditate, the five hindrances are suppressed from time to time. Later due to work, some unavoidable reason, if we are not practicing the meditation, all the five hindrances is overpowering the mind. There is a struggle between good and bad. Yet in meditation, you can become very peaceful. So if you really want to overcome the five hindrances, become a monk. Now you have five hindrances, so just keep them under control. Be a good person. You still have lust. You still have desire. It keeps the economy going, desire. And you get ill will now and again, but just don't follow it. So all these things, they're just part of life. So in meditation, you can let them go and become very peaceful. Know what it's like when things like greed and ill will go obsess the mind. Which means when you know how it feels not to have like desire and anger, you know, just for a few days when you're meditating, you go back home and think, look, why am I going to get angry at home? And people who meditate a lot, they have far less anger and ill will when they go to the office or when they get home. There was this story of this Australian man who wanted to come on one of my meditation retreats. It was only for the weekend, so he asked his wife, can I go on the retreat this weekend? And she said, no, we're too busy. You've got to do the shopping, you've got to fix up the garage, you've got to take the kids to sport, there's too many things, of course you can't go. So he said, okay. Next time's a weekend retreat, he asked again, darling, can I go on a weekend meditation? Of course you can't go, mother's coming. We've got to take the kids to the dentist, there's too much things to do. No, you can't go, but he kept on trying. Every time's a retreat, he asked, he got the same answer. He's too busy. And then one weekend, he said, darling, it's a weekend retreat, can I go? And she got so frustrated, okay, you just go and leave me with all the work. So he went. But what happened next was that when he came home from a weekend retreat, his hindrances, his desires and ill will were so suppressed. He was such a lovely man to live with. He was so soft and sensitive and just really nice and cuddly. And she noticed the change, that when it came to the next weekend retreat, he never needed to ask. She gave him the money and sent him off. Other people notice after a retreat that you become more peaceful and happy. So you can actually see that something is working there, the five hindrances are becoming suppressed. Please explain how to accept the worldly praise. In the mind is always craving for it. When it hears the words of praise, there is a pleasant feeling in the body and the mind. When it misses, it feels very much miserable. To get the pleasant feeling, it wants more praise. In the mind, it develops the pride and conceit unknowingly. Its characteristics are to make the mind more stiff and rigid. Once the mind becomes rigid and stiff, there will be gentleness and humbleness, and unknowingly hurting and harming others. This is the subtlest of hindrances in the attainment of nirvana. No, it actually works the other way around. Because usually when you receive praise, you increase your self-esteem. When you increase your self-esteem, you don't have to try so hard other people, which means you're more soft and gentle. And when you get lots of praise, you can take the criticisms of life and the difficulties of life because you know you're valued and cared for. And so often, especially in a family, we think we're not really cared for, we're not really valued. Every time I work so hard and my wife always says it's not enough money and I'm coming home too late and I'm not looking after her, my part of the family duties. And I just work so hard. All I ever get when I get home is criticism and scolding. Here we go again. Leave it on the ground.
And of course, because you don't get praise, you don't feel valued. And therefore the relationship falls apart. It's the same you, you know, you're trying your very best, you wives, and your husband hardly appreciates you. But he does appreciate you, just doesn't say it. So that's why we need to have more and more praise, so we realize we're valued. Praise is an expression of compassion. So please, be kind and praise each other a lot. It really, really works. It's very, very effective. When I was building a monastery in Perth, again, I told the story of the brick wall. This is the plumbing story. Because I also had to work out how to have plumbing, you know, from the toilets and the showers. And I've never done any plumbing before. We had the plans, we could not afford a plumber. So what I did, I went to the big plumbing shop, put the plans on the table and said, help. And it was a reasonably large building we were doing, so it was worth the salesman's time to explain to me how plumbing worked. It was actually pretty simple once you get to, you know, the principles down. So he spent about half an hour explaining what I needed, got all the parts for me. We took them back to the monastery and I spent the next week putting them all together. And because it's plumbing, you have to get a health inspector to come and check it before you can use it. The health inspector came and it worked, and he ticked it off. It worked, so we succeeded. And so the next day I got the bill from the plumbing shop. And so I got our treasurer to write out a check, and I wrote a note to the plumbing company, said, I'm so happy that our plumbing works, and I want to say thank you to Fred. He was the guy who served me for showing me how to put all the bits together. And it passed this morning. I'm so happy. And I sent that letter with the check. Now what happened, I didn't realize that this wasn't just a small shop. It was a whole company with many, many shops throughout Australia. So the check and the letter went to the accounts clerk. And apparently when he opened the letter and saw, so he opened the envelope and saw there was a letter with the check, he thought, oh no, another complaint. Because the only time people write letters to companies is to complain. And when he read the letter and it was actually praising, he sent it to his boss, the head of the accounts department, who sent it to the managing director of the whole company. And the managing director read this, that some customer was praising one of his workers, and he got on the telephone to Fred. And the managing director talked to Fred and said, Fred, I've just got this letter from one of your customers. I didn't do it, sir. It wasn't me. Fred, it's not a complaint. It's praise. You did a great job. Oh, yeah, that was me, sir. Or something like that. And the boss said, look, Fred, this is what we want in our company. Customer service. You've done a great job. Oh, yes, sir. This is a sort of example I want to see in my company. Oh, yes, sir. I'm trying my very best. Fred, you're just a good employee. What salary are you on? Oh, well, you know, not that much, sir. I think we're going to do something about that. Thank you, sir. And his mate, the other man working in the shop, heard that conversation. Who the heck was that? He said, that was the boss. He's going to give me a raise. And so you can imagine how happy Fred felt. But what happened, just by chance, there was another job I had apart which was far too small. So I went in that shop the same afternoon. Now, ahead of me in that shop were these two big Australian plumbers with shoulders as wide as septic tanks. Big guys, strong, you know, hard workers. And as soon as Fred saw me, he smiled, he beamed, he said, Bram, come over here. And the other plumbers had to wait as I got first service. And I remember his mate said, ah, Fred, your wife's come, meaning me, because I had actually praised him. And he told me what had happened that morning. He got a call from the managing director and a raise in salary because of this simple letter of thanks which I'd sent and which had reached the MD. He said, "Brian, what do you want?" And I said, "Look, I've got this part and it's too small." "Come around the back. Look, Fred, there's a sign saying no customers behind the back." "Oh, it doesn't matter for you." And he took me around the back and I found this part. Because it was twice the size, it was about four times the price. So I said, "Oh, now, what's the difference, Fred? How much do I owe you?" And Fred said, "Brian, for you, no difference." And that's just from a little bit of praise. And how far that got. I got VIP service, you know, priority, and got this big part, you know, which I should have paid some money for, so our Buddhist society, our monastery, made on this simply because I praised somebody. And I've done that for my whole life. Praise gets you everywhere. Flattery gets you everywhere. You flatter your wife. "Wife, you're so beautiful. You know, I'm just so lucky to have met someone like you." Try it. It's amazing just the rewards you will get. So that's actually, praise does not have any negativity at all. Because we all want it. We want self-esteem, we want to be valued. We get enough criticism in this world, but nowhere near enough praise. Ajahn Brahm, "I was a former Christian, so was I. I was told that when bad things happen to good people, or when an innocent young boy dies young, it's God's will. It is a test from God. We cannot doubt God nor question God. It is God's plan." That never made sense to me. Because it seemed, you know, why did God do these things? It didn't make any sense. And it's God's will. And in fact, it was St. Augustine. This was one of the early church fathers who was one of the greatest of Christian philosophers. He said, suffering exists in this world. Therefore, if God is all-powerful, he cannot be all-kind. Because if he was all-powerful, why doesn't he stop some of the suffering and pain in this world? Again, kids dying young, having cancer, people dying in horrific car accidents. And these are very good people, they haven't done anything really wrong. Why are they punished? So he said, if there is a God, he cannot be both all-powerful and all-kind. If he's all-powerful, he should have done something, which means he can't be kind. If he's all-kind, he can't be powerful. If he's so kind, it must mean he cannot intervene. So he argued very logically and very powerfully, if there is a God, it cannot be omnipotent and all-loving at the same time. Because the evidence of life, the existence of suffering, means it can't be all-powerful and all-loving. And that's from a great Christian theologian. So, a test from God. Doesn't this sound like fate? Our life already be determined with no recourse, all of the hand of God. Why can it be done to overcome? What can be done to overcome fate if there's such a view as fate from the Buddhist point of view? There is no such thing as fate according to the Buddhist point of view. Because you are always making karma. Every moment of your life you're interfering with your destiny. It's a wonderful thing to know that your destiny is in your hands right now. You can turn things around at any moment, which is why we are alive, why we come to centers like this, to learn how we can take control of our fate and not be victims of fate. The law of karma means that you can take charge of your destiny. It's not predetermined, it's just work in action. So which means you can always do something with what you've got. You have difficult situations, you're dealt a difficult hand in life, but it's the way you play that hand, the way you play the cards, is the cause of your success. So it's not predetermined at all. It's not your fault. Whatever is happening to you, you can make it work. That's the meaning of life. Please make life work. So, it's not God's will, it's your will. That's the most important thing. Thank you very much for conducting this retreat. I deserve that. Remember that talk the other night? Could you please enlighten us on how lay people live their lives using the Eightfold Path? Very easy to live your life. Lay people, monk people, doesn't really matter, we're all people. So you just, you know, the Eightfold Path is just, in brief, Sila Samadhi Panya. Sila is not doing anything which harms yourself or harms another person. That's morality. So be someone who doesn't harm others or doesn't harm yourself. It's common sense. Drinking alcohol harms you. Certainly harms your wallet. It costs a lot of money. So it's really stupid doing that. Adultery, having a mistress, it harms your whole family and harms your reputation. That's why it's immoral. It's just not worth it. Now, having one wife is enough suffering. Having a mistress as well, it's crazy. Okay, and just lying, you eventually get caught and killing other beings and just stealing. It's just not worth it. So wise people keep their precepts. So you're virtuous, Sila Samadhi, and you're peaceful. You have to have some attention and stillness and mindfulness in life. You're going to succeed no matter what you're doing in life. So having a bit of meditation really helps whatever profession you have in life. And I'll talk about that at the end of this retreat. And lastly, wisdom. Does wisdom help your lay life? Of course it helps every type of life. That's why you're coming here, to learn wisdom. So you learn wisdom, you learn how to be peaceful, you learn how to be virtuous, and of course that helps every aspect of life. So remember, Eightfold Path is just a threefold training in virtue, peace and wisdom. And obviously it helps all parts of life. So learn to be more virtuous, more peaceful, more wise, whatever station of life you're in. Now we've got some more questions. We've got to finish them off in 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 1 minute. My goodness. Well, I'll go through them quickly. When we are born into this world, it is determined that we have to leave this world at a certain date. Yes, it's called your death. Is it that we take care of our health, we can live longer, so death is not certain? The time of your death is not certain, but the fact you will die is certain. I was really touched with what you said in the morning about animals being fear. Would you please share it with the public so that they could understand why animals attack us and be kind to them? Because animals are very small and we're more powerful. So imagine that you were in front of a tiger. Would you be afraid? Why? Because the tiger's more powerful than you. Even if the tiger may be a Buddhist and may be a vegetarian, you've got nothing to fear, but you don't know that, so therefore you're afraid. So imagine like a dog or a cat or a mouse, and they see you, or even a snake. You are so much bigger and more powerful than they are, they get very afraid. So please look after the animals. Don't give them fear. If you see a snake, say, "You're okay. I'm not going to eat you. I'm not going to kill you. You're fine." And then the snake won't bite you because it'll feel, "Oh, this person likes me. I don't need to be afraid." So that way we can be kind to animals, because animals feel fear. They're always afraid. And that's why that we have to care for them, because it's, imagine what you would be like if you lived with tigers and you saw tigers every day. You'd be so terrified. That's what animals are like. You could hurt them so easily. How to handle the Dharma effect? I did this one already. I don't think I've done these ones. Oh no, I haven't. I did this one though. This one's done. Okay, maybe one more question. I'll do the one at the end there because it's humble, and then we'll finish off for tonight. These ones I'll do tomorrow. There's a saying that for every temporary failure, there are seeds for greater opportunities in success, happiness and purpose in life. Yes, that's why that in modern business they call it forward failure. It's a great word. So you fail, but you fall forward. In other words, you're further along the track in life, further with wisdom, further with compassion. So when you fail, you haven't lost, you've actually gained. More wise, more understanding about the nature in life. So don't be afraid of failing. I know in business people have to take risks. There are many times when you start a business you fail several times before eventually you win. You become millionaire. But all millionaires, the first time they failed, they didn't work the first time, but they kept on going. Every time they failed, they picked themselves up because they realized it was forward failing. And I tried again. And I say that because without innovation, economies like Malaysia will just go backwards. We do need entrepreneurs, people willing to take risks, willing to fail, to get that new business going. And they fail 3 or 4 times, the next time they make it. And then we have big business which they can employ many, many people and help the economy of this country. That's why we have to allow people to fail.
Most people react emotionally to situations instead of respond to the situation with positive and happy results. Would you appreciate if your team can organize workshops to help and improve the quality of the devotee's life by sharing the knowledge of the above skills and knowledge? That's what we're doing here. It's called meditation retreat. So this is the workshop. So yes, we give that over to the organizers. They can have more workshops, but this is actually how, instead of reacting emotionally to situations, we can respond with compassion and peace, no matter what happens in life. And that way we can be happier people. So this is the workshop, and there are more workshops coming tomorrow and the day afterwards, and there's more talks coming. And so this is the end of the talk this evening. Unfortunately, you have to react to this with peace, because I'm getting tired and you have to go home, you have to work tomorrow morning. And tomorrow night's talk, what's tomorrow night's talk? You used to have to give the trailer for the next movie coming your way. What? Superstition? Ah, beliefs and superstitions. That's a great talk. So now I can actually see all the superstitions about ghosts and spirits and about things which go bump in the night and how to overcome those.